From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm David Crabtree. November may seem like a long way off, but campaigning for the 2006 election is on in North Carolina. Candidates for elected offices began registering on February 12th. They have until the end of the month to sign up, and primaries take place on the 2nd of May. Most candidates have been raising funds and staking their allegiances for months at a time when campaign finance and political friendships are under the microscope in North Carolina. In Raleigh, federal investigators continue to pursue documents and testimony about whether Speaker Jim Black's office broke campaign finance rules. State Attorney General Roy Cooper has called for an investigation into corruption in state government. Meanwhile, there's still a chance the new lottery could be halted on legal grounds. As political hopefuls of both parties define their platforms, what effect will all these scandals have on the outcome of upcoming elections? We're joined in the studio by a group of political reporters. Laura Leslie is a reporter with North Carolina Public Radio. Mark Schreiner reports for the Wilmington Star News. And Mark Johnson, joining us by phone, is a reporter with the Charlotte Observer. Welcome to everyone.
Hey, David.
Okay. One of the great signs that the race is on. Just last week, the state Republican Party asked North Carolina churches for copies of their directories. There was a debate about this in the national election in 2004. This sounds like, at first glance, a great mixing of church and state. You agree?
It also sounds like a pretty smart campaign strategy. When you look at the actual memo that went out, they say they did a poll. They found out that most people who regularly attend churches do tend to vote Republican, and they're asking for their mailing list to contact these folks and to send them get-out-the-vote materials and registration forms. And, you know, that's what the Republicans do very, very, very well. And it's not really a surprise, I guess, to see this come through your inbox. But, you know, I think in a sense, it's really the Democrats' problem here, because the Democrats for so long have ceded any kind of church, religious, spiritual territory to the GOP, and you can't blame the GOP for making good use of that.
Yeah, Jerry Meek with the Democratic Party said last week, we think people should go to churches to worship, not to worry about politics. Bill Peasley said, hey, it's a great place to find voters.
Right. Bill Peasley told me that it shouldn't come to anyone surprised that political parties collect lists. But you know, there is an element of culture, there's an element of Southern culture there, that there is a little bit from the preachers and vestry wardens I talk to, a little bit of a taboo about turning over the church directory to anybody other than a church member. And I think Laura's right in that the Republicans have seized on something here where if they're willing to dispense with that taboo, they can reach a gold mine of potential party members and voters.
Mark Johnson, it sounds like it could be a little messy, though.
Well, one thing that strikes me is, the complaints are coming from the Democrats. There have been several Democratic campaigns that I've followed on the trail, and one of their regular tactics is to put flyers on the windshields of cars parked at churches, especially African-American churches. So the complaints from the Democrats, there's a little bit of a hollowness there. Mark did hit on it in that you do kind of think twice. I think that one of the Republican responses is probably that Democrats have a number of built-in constituency groups, unions, teachers unions, these sorts of groups where they automatically basically get lists and get support. And I think they're trying to counter that a little bit.
And then there was this, Bill Peasley with the state Republican Party, in a response, I think, to what some of the Democrats were saying, said this, and I'm quoting, "The Democrats may feel it's more profitable to go and do a voter registration drive at a homosexual convention. We feel more comfortable going to churches." Now, what's that all about?
Well, it sounds like politics to me.
But, I mean, if that's not over the line, it sure steps up to the line, doesn't it?
It's called red meat for the right wing. And the core voters, the people they're trying to get in these churches, the Christian conservatives, the people that are going to react to that kind of language. I mean, it's all one and the same. It's all part of that same strategy of approaching those core voters, the people who are going to get out the vote for you. And asking for the church mailing list, I think, is right. Just a part of that.
Well, it also gives you an insight into political operations today, which is that there's two major strategies, and one is to come up with a broad message and try to appeal to as many people as possible, And I think both parties try to do that. But then you see a second sort of ground strategy that says we find groups of people that have a high percentage of response to us. And we try to take ownership of these particular, well, ownership's perhaps the wrong word, but you try to link with these groups. And you see the same thing not only in politics but in fundraising. I mean, imagine if you're raising money. You want to go after the folks that you know will give and have a lot of money. And you cut out sort of the static.
Speaking of money, Jim Black, the name that comes up over and over as House Speaker, the North Carolina State House of Representatives, goes through the hearings before the state elections, the state election board. And as an optometrist, we all of a sudden find out his eyesight is in question as far as who wrote what on checks. And he has an opponent now. Any surprise there, Laura?
You knew that he was going to have to face an opponent. And actually, he faced opponents in 99, 2001. The last cycle was actually the only time that he's been speaker that he hasn't faced an opponent. But I certainly think that he is going to be the target for the Republican Party as they try to move out into this next primary and general election cycle. And, you know, one of the things that you know that they're going to be attacking the Democrats for is Jim Black, is the corruption, the hearings, the federal and state investigations that even if perhaps don't target the Speaker's office, as Jim Black keeps saying, that he's not the target of the federal investigation, but if the target is a circle of dots all the way around your office, then you got to figure you're in the crosshairs.
Yeah, Mark Johnson, will Jim Black's ultimate opponent be a federal grand jury or the State Board of Elections versus Hal Jordan?
Certainly the State Board of Elections, and also I would throw in there his own caucus within the House, because as Laura pointed out, you know, he's had opponents before, but I mean, the district is pretty lopsided Democratic. It's hard to see how he would struggle within the district. But he is elected Speaker, as many of your listeners know, by the members of the Democratic caucus. And it's when you start to see some cracks there that he's got serious problems. And I think, and we've all done stories in the past couple weeks where we've got members who a few weeks ago were saying, you know, he hasn't been accused of anything, we're still behind him. Well, now their comments they're shifted a little bit, because he has been accused of things by the State Board of Elections, and it's a more qualified support.
I would presume those within his caucus, though, would be very careful about making waves, because if they were to issue anything that looks like a challenge and he retains control, then they're on the short end.
Sure, and the members I've talked to, the ones, what they'll say publicly is they're looking for some nice, easy way to know that they should jump off the ship. And a lot of them use the word indictment or some official court paper that's going to say that this is a good, convenient place where they should leave Jim Black's caucus.
Well, what you hear other ones say, and Bob Hall, too, he's the chairman of director of Democracy NC, the folks that started this investigation into the optometrists and video poker. What you hear a lot of them say is that the real problem here is the system. And I don't think anybody's writing Jim Black a blank check, no pun intended, you know, for what he's done. But what they're saying is that we have a system that forces politicians, them and the speaker, into this endless search for money. And that when you have a system that encourages you to find loopholes like this, then you shouldn't be surprised when people do. So I'll be interested. I think I'm hearing a lot of what Mark is, too. Unless there's an indictment or something solid that people can you know, sort of hold up on the campaign podium, they're not going to back off, Jim Black.
And that's is part of the difficulty for them, is that they recognize the bad publicity, the stain, basically, that some of these stories and controversies are putting on the party, though the degree of that is kind of debatable at the moment. But they recognize that at the same time, Speaker Black has been a very, very effective fundraiser. And remember that he takes that money, he doesn't use it on his own campaign in his district, he gives it to candidates, Democratic candidates for the House in districts that need that help. So there are a lot of folks that are in debt to him and will need him in the coming elections.
He has $1 million right now in his war chest.
Wow.
Which is, to me, sounds like a tremendous amount of money for a member of the state legislature. Obviously, Mark Johnson, what you're talking about, most of that money in that safe seat would go, I presume, to help other candidates, or at least to help the party.
Right. And what we have seen in North Carolina, we're actually late to this whole process by which the price of running for office has just skyrocketed. I mean, it happened at the congressional level in years past, and it's happened in other states. And it's really only in the past few years here in North Carolina that we've seen the prices, the costs jump up like this. And because he is so effective of a fundraiser, you know, that takes a huge burden off these candidates in, especially in the very, there are very few swing districts, but in those swing districts or in, you know, districts where they're just not able to raise much money, you know, money is the lifeblood of a campaign, not only in terms of being able to pay your bills, but being able to advertise. I mean, money is speech these days.
Yeah, and very quickly before we take a break, we talk about, or we hear talk about reform every couple of years. Problems with lobbyists, problems with campaign finances, nothing really changes.
It's because we're asking the people who benefit from the system to change the system that got them where they are. And that just doesn't make any sense, I think, to anyone. I mean, if you really want meaningful reform, I think it's going to take a group of people who are not in office and don't owe their current position to the system that got them there.
And how can that happen?
I'm not quite sure.
In our lifetime, it may or may right. not. This is The State of Things. We are talking today about how legal troubles in Speaker Black's office could impact the upcoming primaries and elections. We're joined by Laura Leslie with North Carolina Public Radio, Mark Schreiner with the Wilmington Star News, and Mark Johnson from the Charlotte Observer. And we'd like to hear from you, taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. Just ahead, does North Carolina need another big port? You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcast from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm David Crabtree. We are talking today about news from the state capitol. State and federal investigations are underway, looking at campaign finance and illegal lobbying. Meanwhile, political newcomers are entering the scene. They're filing their registration to run for office in the 2006 primaries. How will the political scandals affect the races? We're joined by Laura Leslie, reporter at North Carolina Public Radio, Mark Schreiner with the Wilmington Star News, and Mark Johnson with the Charlotte Observer. I want to go right to what we ended the first segment on, the proposal for a new large port in eastern North Carolina.
That's
Mark,
right.
Mark, you have written about it. You said you dream about what you've written about this.
not voluntarily.
Okay, the Council of State has approved $30 million for the purchase
of a very nice
tract of land.
A very nice piece of Brunswick County. About 600 acres, $30 million. It's a piece of industrial property on the Cape Fear River, about 9.5 miles from the open ocean. And the dream, which only started after Thanksgiving, is that this on this land could rise one of the largest container shipping ports on the East Coast. And it has to do with the way Americans buy things and where they buy them from. I defy anybody to go into a major retailer these days and try to find more than just a handful of consumer products that aren't made in Asia. And the American, everybody knows a lot about how Americans are buying more and more stuff overseas. Well, they come to us in shipping containers, these large steel boxes that you see leaving ships and going onto trucks. And the capacity, the ability to move these boxes onto land, onto trains, into trucks, is shrinking. There's so much business, and so ports in Wilmington, Charleston, Savannah, Mobile, Norfolk, New York are looking for ways to expand to accept more of these containers. And so the folks who run the North Carolina State Ports Authority see a great piece of opportunity in this piece of land. But there are a lot of questions.
Lots of questions, and I mean the approval for this purchase of this land has happened,
right?
But if that land was bought today and everything went smoothly, when would we see a port in operation?
Probably,
how many years?
Probably 7 years at the earliest.
At least.
Yeah. It's very complicated. I wrote a story where basically to get this port off the ground, they're going to have to do a lot of persuading. They're going to have to persuade the Congress of the United States to come up with maybe $300 or $400 million. Or share that to dredge the Cape River, which was just recently dredged by the Corps of Engineers, persuade our state legislature to come up with sort of matching money, and persuade a major international port operator to partner with them on this project. And, of course, that company would have to be convinced that there was profit to be had.
We're taking your phone calls at 1-877-962-9862. Let's go to Pete in Carrboro. Pete?
Hi. My comment is this. Right before the break, your panelist said something to the effect, and I think rightly so, that it's very hard to get politicians who benefit from the system to vote to change the system for ethics reform, campaign finance reform, and other long overdue kinds of reforms. And I think that's right to an extent, but on the other hand, if a scandal like this doesn't do it, what will? And it seems to me the only thing that will is, well, we have to understand that people in the legislature and people around politics have lost their sense of smell about what stinks about politics. They're in it so much that they're just immune from it. And it takes the grassroots folks out there very actively and insistently reminding them that it is stinking and they better fix it in order for it to get fixed. But I'm fairly hopeful that a scandal like this can be a major nudge to ethics and campaign finance reform. And I wonder what your folks there.
Okay, Pete, thanks for the call. Let's weigh in on this.
I have to jump in and defend some of the legislators here. I don't think they've all lost their sense of smell. I think the vast majority of the legislators down there that I know and report on are good people with a strong sense of ethics. But the problem is that if you've got one person in a system who is getting around that system and finding loopholes, then in order to be competitive with that person, it forces you to do the same thing. And so, the old adage about one bad apple, it really, really applies when you're talking about large amounts of money and difficult campaigns in swing districts. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, sure. The important thing is that Speaker Black is at the head of the system, at the head of the process, and it all feeds into itself in the sense that he wants to preserve his job and be the leader, and also as leader, he can spread that money around. But as a caller, I think ethics could become a campaign issue, and that just like we're seeing in Congress these days, members of the state legislature may want to wear the badge of ethics reform and make that a part of their campaigns because they've got to dispel this scent of scandal.
Mark Johnson?
Well, I just, the unfortunate thing, I will be the ugly cynic.
Thank you, Mark.
and I certainly fit that. The unfortunate thing is that I suspect there is a good share of the public for which the controversies around the Speaker's office and other people probably just don't have much of an effect in terms of how they vote. I suspect that there's just a lot of folks out there that they see the headlines or hear the stories and basically conclude, well, they're all doing it. They're all dirty. And so things like the campaign money shuffling around, the partially blank checks, doesn't have a huge impact. What seems to have a little more impact is when some of these things have an immediate effect on their lives, like one of the stories around the Speaker's office had to do with the mandatory eye exams for kindergartners that he put into the budget. I mean, I noticed a lot more reader feedback, public irritation over that, because, you're telling me I have to spend what before my child can, and they can't go to school if I don't what? Those kinds of reactions.
And he's, and Speaker Black is what?
An optometrist.
Exactly. Let's go to Doug in Raleigh. Doug, good afternoon to you.
Yeah, hi. I'm on my mobile. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment on your port expansion issue. I could not disagree more emphatically with one of your panelists saying that there is such a need for increased container shipments. There is a huge excess of cargo, empty containers on the ocean right now. We experienced this in a port fight in Charleston, South Carolina, where the state ports authority there was trying to expand the Charleston port more than basically was Miami and L.A. combined, that kind of size. They took into no account the impacts on infrastructure. The studies they came out with were incredibly skewed, showing that there would be minimal impact on containers coming onto the interstate system. And I would just caution North Carolina that before they invest in a new port expansion, you know, what the real need is, what the impacts on the environment, on the local infrastructure, and, you know, the standard of living for the people on the coast. Because everything we saw, it was a complete lose-lose proposition.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for your call. Mark?
Well, there are a lot of people like Doug, and they have a point. And what I said was that this decision to buy this piece of property was based on the Port Authority's projections, just as he discussed. Now, there is going to have to be a debate over whether those projections are indeed accurate and whether or not there is business there to be had.
Three of the members of the Council of State, three of the 10 who voted for this, would like to be governor, state treasurer, state attorney general, the lieutenant governor, all said yes. What if this thing falls through? $30 million spent on this land. Does this come back to haunt them?
Well, I don't know. We've had public expansion projects like this. I think everybody, or a lot of people, agree that something like RTP has been a great success, right? But then there have been
global.
Now you got the global.
Then there's a global transpark, and so I suppose it has to be shown yet whether this North Carolina International Port will be an example A or example B.
All right, we're taking your phone calls 1-877-962-9862. Let's go to Albert in Greensboro. Albert.
I want to speak on the issue concerning the church mailing list. You made a statement that one of your guests made a statement that most church, people who go to church tend to vote Republican, and I think I don't think I agree with that. You know, there are good Christians in the Republican Party, and there are good Christians in the Democratic Party. So, if we could use the word "some," and let me please speak to this issue, because there are two types of Christians. There are those who would hold demonstrating that they are against abortion, they are against homosexuals, and then they will also say the Ten Commandments on a wall, a plaque put in office, whatever. And then there are others also who believe that the Ten Commandments, according to the Word of God, in the grace dispensation, is written on the tables of our hearts. So they could care less if you remove those structures from courthouse, or because it is on the tables of our hearts. So we have one brand, which is the Pharisaical in nature, and there are the other group who follow Christ. Mm-hmm. They are willing to turn the other cheek when you slap them. They are peace-loving. So when you do it between the two, they don't all vote for the same party. There are those who vote Democratic because they will say, well, if I look around, I see those who want, they are ones who love their neighbor as themselves.
Okay, so, Albert, thank you very much for your call. And I hear what he's saying, but I also sensed where you were going with that, Laura, is that traditionally, more within the evangelical wing of churches have been energized to vote and have voted for more traditional / conservative candidates.
Absolutely. The poll that we were talking about, or the reason we said that, is because it's this poll that was conducted by the Republican National Committee. Now, whether or not that poll is good, you know, and whether or not it was skewed, we don't really know that because we don't have those numbers. But this is what the Republicans themselves are saying about people who go to church. And I think Albert has a point. There are certainly a lot of good Christians mm-hmm. who are not Republican. But the point is that the Republicans have done a much better job than the Democrats at reaching out to those communities of faith and mobilizing them to support their core platform issues.
And have been more vocal on issues of faith at times than Democrats have been, at least some Democrats have been in the past. So again, not all, but some.
Yeah, and David, I would just chime in that, you know, it's not just the Republicans' polls. It's basically pretty much any serious political polling operation that has touched on this issue. What they find is that, you know, they sort of rank it. Do you attend church more than once a week, you know, how often? Mm-hmm. And the folks that are at the top there, the ones that go the most, if you look at their what they call voting performance, you know, who they voted for, it's just very lopsided towards the Republicans. So there's really not much debate over that.
Let's take another call, this one from Laura. Laura?
Hi. I wanted to make a comment in regard to what Pete had said earlier about voter awareness of issues.
Yes.
Where legislators, sometimes the grassroots constituents, are much more aware of legislators' special interests and gift giving and campaign donations, etc. And I think there's a lot more a vibrant level of communication going on now because of the internet. that a lot of times the analysts anticipate, and I think it's going to start figuring in more come election time.
Well, Laura, if that is true, and it very well may be, then why have we continued to see primarily the same people return to office, even if there have been questions about ethics or questions about legal issues over the years? It is rare, at least my memory saying it's rare, unless it has been a tremendously public issue that came with an indictment, that someone was turned out of office.
Well, I think if some of us become more specifically aware of where certain legislators are involved in certain industries that affect large bodies of people, like with the adult care facilities issue and how many people leave the our mental hospitals and end up going straight into just another level of institutions with very little choice involved. This is something that's being perpetuated with some involvement.
Laura, thank you for your call very much. She hits on something that I think is key, and hopefully she is right, that more people will be paying closer attention to issues that are represented by either members of the House or Senate that they really want to see handled differently.
I was just going to say, as for her point about emails, too, I know that Senate President Pro Tem Mark Basnight told a bunch of us reporters at the end of last session that emails are changing the way that constituents connect with their legislators, and they are having a lot more influence than they used to. You know, the phone bank doesn't get full or the voicemail doesn't get full. They just get scads and scads of emails. So she could have a point that there, you know, there could be a more of a groundswell of activism, grassroots activism.
And there's something about seeing it in writing. Even though it could come from a source that has no credibility whatsoever, it pops up on your screen and you pay attention to it differently sometimes than even a telephone call.
Yeah, how many times have we gotten, you know, something has been forwarded to, you know, a reader or a unfortunately for me, even family members. you know, absolutely complete myth, you know, everything from the Neiman Marcus cookie recipe to, you know, something that Congress is going to do. But, you know, it's email, so, oh, my God, it must be true.
Well, but I think if any email that comes from a lawmaker's constituent is relevant, period. And, you know, if they see that inbox full of those messages, they're going to respond to that. But I wanted to go back to what she was saying about the activists and the grassroots folks, which is that even, for example, the head of the Democratic Party, Jerry Meek, who was really brought into power in the Democratic Party because he represents that sort of activist grassroots stuff, he put out a list of 10 proposals for government reform. But even so, he's missing a couple of really key points, and you have to ask yourself why, for example, one of the things that we talk about as political reporters is that we talk about campaign limits and contribution limits. But what a lot of people don't know is that there's no limit on what I can give to the party, and there's no limit on what the party can give to me. So, you know, not having any kind of limits on that makes most of the other limits meaningless because the party is dishing out most of the money in the first place. That's something I didn't see on the Democratic Party's list of proposed reforms. And that's, I think, I don't know if it's because it's too complicated and people don't want to address it, or I don't know whether maybe the Democratic Party and the other party don't want to address it.
Well, it's like, okay, say we do it and my opponent does not, so I'm at a disadvantage, straightforward. I mean, will we ever see both major political parties come together and say exactly what you're talking about, Laura? We are calling for this to cease.
Gosh, I
today.
Don't. I don't know. I mean, what's the view from 50,000 feet? And the view from 50,000 feet is that, as Mark indicated, money is the lifeblood of politics, and you need that. And what the grassroots want, I think, from their elected officials is a good fight with the other party, and you fight with money. And why are the Democrats and Republicans spending all this kind of money? That's because they're trying to establish a clear majority in the state House and the state Senate, which they've had difficulty doing over the last 10 years. And I suppose it one of the possibilities that it may end would be when one party finally establishes a dissent-proof majority where they can get things done.
Mark Johnson, I'm sure that there were people from Charlotte who headed south of the border last week to buy a Powerball ticket.
Yes, I called some of them and tried to get them to buy me one.
With that in mind, Judge Height last week says the injunction, no, I will not stop the lottery from at least the scratch-off date from moving forward. However, this lawsuit can move forward challenging the constitutionality of the legislature's actions. What do you think about this?
Well, the most important thing here is how quickly this case gets to the state Supreme Court, because that's where the opponents of the lottery are trying to get it, because they think, with some justification, they will get a sympathetic hearing there, and because that court could indeed put the brakes on it. So kind of what we're seeing, and Judge Hyde is a very well-respected judge and handled some really tough cases last year, but what all this really is just warm-up to getting it to the Supreme Court, because as we saw with the case over the absentee or out-of-precinct ballots, the majority on that court is willing to listen to, you know, basically political arguments on some of these cases.
Sounds like, though, if you were looking in a crystal ball, you would think people will be scratching these tickets early March.
Certainly looks that way, but you just, you know, don't know how fast the court could move. But it would be surprising if they were it would be able to get to the Supreme Court before that happens.
Very quickly, do you agree?
Oh, sure. It's a political issue that's probably going to be settled in a courtroom.
Laura?
I would just say I can't imagine once this thing's really rolling and underway, I would have a hard time seeing the Supreme Court really have the political will to put the brakes on it and roll up the tickets and send them back. So,
Laura Leslie with North Carolina Public Radio, Mark Schreiner with the Wilmington Star News, and Mark Johnson with the Charlotte Observer. My thanks to all of you. Just ahead, U.S. presidents have been plagued with mental illness over the years. We'll hear how it affected their presidencies coming up on The State of Things.